Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Today's talk is called Neurodiversity and Mindfulness. I'm Bonnie Sarmiento. I think a lot of you know me. We're going to talk about the science of mindfulness, the effects of meditation on the brain, including trauma-informed mindfulness, and the myth of the average brain. I recently completed a mindful certification, which was architected by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams and David Perrin, both who are meditation teachers. Rev Angel is one of the very few Black women Zen priests we have here in the US and has also been an inspiration to me for many years. Several examples that I'm going to cite during this talk came from that program. And I will also be sharing examples from my own personal experience, and then we'll have time for Q&A at the end. I'm going to start off with a story from the research of Dr. Sarah King, who investigated a mindfulness intervention program at a middle school. It might have been at multiple middle schools, but it was with a bunch of middle schoolers affected by Hurricane Sandy, which hit on the East Coast in 2012. After the hurricane, many middle schoolers in this region were suffering from homelessness, sometimes abuse and vulnerability, and all kinds of trauma. So people decided, we're going to create a mindfulness program to intervene to help these troubled kids out. The mindfulness intervention program started, and it was mandatory that these middle schoolers who are facing acute trauma at the time in the aftermath of this hurricane would have to attend mindfulness classes and meditation and things like that. Dr. King researched to see what the results of the program were with these youth. The results of the program were very mixed. The students who participated fell roughly into three groups. One third of the middle schoolers that did this program had breakthrough results. They experienced benefits such as improved grades, decreased school attrition, better social relationships, behavior. They had some kind of remarkable improvement in their life by participating in this mindfulness program and were very happy with it. Another third of the middle school students said they were neutral. They could take it or leave it. They really didn't feel any difference by participating in this program. And the last one third of students participating were so upset that they got together, organized themselves, and formed a petition to throw the mindfulness program out of their middle school. Wow. It's like, why would anyone do that? And yet they were organizing, demanding that this program be taken out of their school. It kind of makes you wonder, how could anyone hate meditation that much, right? First of all, I want to say that at Canando, we know that you should never force children to meditate. It's just not a good idea. Even under good circumstances, that's like one of the worst things you could do is make a child hate meditation because they were forced to do it and had no choice. But in this case, the effects were even worse. The fact is that in general, mindfulness and meditation training make us more sensitive, not less. And so having people of any age meditate while experiencing acute trauma without having resources to help them cope with that trauma, such as a way to get them into a safe home, a way to get them out of an abusive situation, a way to get them away from violence or harm. If we cannot solve the root causes of suffering, then having them meditate in silence would actually just make them more sensitive to the suffering they were already experiencing and worsen the trauma and exacerbate harm. I've known some people who, when they try to do like what we do, regular Zazen, just sitting still quietly, they have experienced so much trauma in their past that they will either relive a traumatic incident or completely leave their bodies and disassociate and have a hard time coming back. People with serious trauma can disassociate because it's too painful to be in their bodies with all that suffering and without mechanisms to cope. So some people, even meditation teachers that I know that have come from a background of severe abuse or trauma, find that other methods such as body scans, guided meditations, where someone's giving them a way to be present in their body with a focus point, doesn't give their mind free rein to start replaying traumatic incidents from the past. So these kids in the study hated the mindfulness program, and they hated it because it wasn't done mindfully, right? They hated it because they were not given any free choice or any agency, and it exacerbated their already strong feelings of being powerless. So in general, people can't experience liberation through meditation if they don't have a choice in whether they can participate. So what is the moral of the story? The moral of the story is we're not all the same, right? We all have different backgrounds, different trauma levels, different cultural experiences, and engaging in meditation or in any mindfulness program or any activity for that matter is going to affect us differently. 1/3 of the kids had breakthrough results and they absolutely loved it. And 1/3 had traumatic breakdowns and 1/3 didn't care, right? So understanding that different people have different needs is important in any community. In Buddhism, we emphasize home leaving because the Buddha left all of the comforts of his home. He left his palace and his riches to go seek wisdom for alleviating suffering. And so many Buddhist monks practice home leaving with the same intention. However, what about people who never really had a stable home to begin with? Right? What about people who are homeless, who don't have a home? Like, for them, their enlightenment might come by finding a home, by starting a family, creating a family that they never had, when previously they never had one or they never had that kind of security, right? So some people might already have a lot of suffering in their lives to resolve without having to go seek out or, you know, cause more suffering to try to process. Now, home leaving can be a very, very powerful form of practice with life transforming results, as long as we don't lose the context of why these retreats were created in the first place. Siddhartha, the Buddha, came from a very privileged background, and he wanted to experience discomfort and suffering to try to understand the root of it. However, people who are born into abusive homes or poverty, sickness, might have a very different journey of healing than what Siddhartha had. When we research enlightenment stories of many bodhisattvas, they are as diverse as you can imagine. Some reached enlightenment through the death of a loved one, some through hard work, others through being born beautiful or less beautiful by society standards, some through being born powerful or not powerful, by being rich and by being poor. The bodhisattvas reached enlightenment in their own unique way, specific to their life and their life's purpose. If Buddha had not been a prince of incredible wealth, who knew that his family would be financially well taken care of in his absence, his journey might have looked very different. if his family was struggling to make ends meet, if Buddha had got paid minimum wage and his child would starve if he left, he might have chose something very different. Yet we have a tendency to try to mimic what the Buddha did in order to attain enlightenment. But we need to remember to look at what is needed in our own unique lives and individual circumstances. How do we take care of this unique life that was entrusted to us? I personally have felt a huge shift and positive impact in my life by attending retreats. But there was only a certain length I could attend reasonably without it negatively impacting my life when I came back. What is the core purpose of all Buddhist practices? At its core, Buddhist practice is about resolving the problem of suffering. So if we go through the motions of Buddhist practice, but it's creating more suffering in our lives, then we've missed the point. And if we do something very unconventional, but somehow it relieves a lot of suffering for ourselves and others, well, then that is effective Buddhist practice. We practice seated meditation because it's the easiest for most people to practice. Again, I said most people. If someone has had a spinal injury, sciatica, pregnancy, sickness, or other injury, they may be better off laying down during meditation. If someone is strong and healthy and they live in a beautiful natural area, they might get more out of a meditative walk out in nature than they would sitting down in a corner. But we practice sitting because it's helpful for a lot of people and it's accessible to most people. But we also need to remember that people are different. And we are also different at different times in our lives. We need different skills and coping mechanisms at different times in our lives. Listen to your body. I once had a teacher who sat Zazen longer than she really should have. Her body was screaming with pain, but she thought, "I'm supposed to continue to sit in the same position and not move under all circumstances." By forcing herself to sit beyond pain and beyond what her body could manage, she permanently injured the connective tissue in her hip area, and she's no longer able to sit cross-legged at all. She has to sit in a chair to meditate all the time in her adult life. So it's good to practice the forms, but we need to be careful not to make Zen so rigid to the point where it creates suffering rather than relieving suffering. Our intention with Zen practice should always be to cause less harm. Another Zen teacher that I know had dietary restrictions. She's gluten-free, like I am. Now, I've been very fortunate whenever I've visited anywhere, they've been so accommodating of my dietary restrictions. And Kenendo has been as well. But this particular teacher had a teacher who didn't accommodate her dietary restrictions. She's gluten-free, and she attended a sesshin and realized she couldn't eat any of the food there. And she tried to talk to her teacher about it, but he would not let her talk and just said, "Do what everyone else is doing." So she couldn't take food, and she couldn't talk about not being able to eat. And so she just sat there while everyone was eating without her. At the end, she had a conversation with her teacher about how did the sesshin go? And he said, "Well, I thought you did great. You practiced denial and you refused food. It was so moving." And she said, "Well, do you want to know how I felt?" He said, "Sure." She said, "Well, I felt really hungry and really exhausted, and I felt sad because I felt excluded, and I couldn't eat for a whole day, and I had no choice." And that was a really hard experience for her. So these kinds of things happen in Zen communities, and it's important for us to understand we want to practice forms, yes, and we want to practice the discipline, but we can't let ourselves get so rigid. People have injuries, they have conditions, they have food restrictions, and if we're truly going to take care of our lives in our communities, we have to respect the diversity that lives in our physical bodies and our minds. American Zen has absorbed a lot of the rigidity of monastic Zen practice, but we sometimes overlook the nuances of other aspects that are also valid ways to practice and softer. Things like tea ceremony and family shrines and the more subtle aspects. Sometimes even in Japanese monasteries, while monks are supposed to only eat at mealtimes, if there isn't enough food, they will often bring in other food to supplement it. They're not going to starve themselves. So taking asceticism to an extreme is not always healthy for everyone. We have unique DNA, physicality, metabolism, racial diversity, cultural diversity, gender identity, sexual orientation, varying trauma levels, varying sleep requirements, varying dietary restrictions, as well as neurological differences, such as having mental health issues and concerns. So if you get nothing else from this talk, the main thing to get across is that our brains and our bodies are different. We don't all share the same average brain. So if a news article says that brains react in certain ways to certain stimulus, such as to meditation or mindfulness practice, just know that that's not necessarily your brain or someone else's brain. It's an average. It's a mythical and idealized brain. It doesn't always map to reality. So we should not assume that some authority figure, whether it's a doctor, expert, or teacher, or news article, knows what's best for us and our lives. They might know some good statistical information. They might have some good stories and good methods and options to look into. But ultimately, we have to pay attention to our own experience and listen to our own bodies, because there's tremendous wisdom in what we uniquely need from practice that no one else can teach us. We can monitor and pay attention to how our practice is affecting us. Different times of day, different durations of meditation. If we do an all-day session, do we feel more centered and clear and balanced? Do we feel irritable? Or do we start having a psychotic episode, right? We need to be checking in with ourselves, because no one outside really knows our internal landscape as well as we do. The other learning from this is that we should not project our experiences on other people. So if we had a great time or a life-changing, wonderful experience in a very intense practice period or prolonged meditation, we should not assume that that means everybody else will have that same wonderful experience. They might, but they might not. If they have pre-existing conditions, contraindications, or different life circumstances, they can have a very different experience. It also could be hard for certain people to be in an environment because there's not enough people like them to relate to. Maybe there's not a lot of people of color. Maybe there's not a lot of other LGBTQ people. And so they don't feel like they can relate as much in a certain community, and therefore would have a different experience than someone who's more of the mainstream identity of the community. So we can't tell people what to do or give them false expectations of what to expect. I do think it's beneficial to share our experiences and what has been helpful for us, because I can guarantee you that something you've done that has helped you tremendously will help someone else. It will. it just might not help everyone else. When I was doing mentoring work with youth at risk, I found that I was really able to connect with and help a lot of youth that had similar backgrounds as me, similar challenges. For example, I had been through depression. I was able to understand what it felt like to be depressed. I could communicate with youth who felt depressed and help them find ways to cope with it. But then there would be other youth who were involved with gangs. And I don't know anything about gangs. I've never been in a gang. And I learned a little bit secondhand from the community. But if a youth came with a gang problem, I would instantly refer them to another mentor that had gang experience and could guide them through it, or at least tell us some resources and options to get help. And in these programs, I had to do a lot of training every year for 9 years. And the majority of that training was understanding differences and understanding that what's normal for one person is completely different than what's normal for another person. Anytime we're working with a population that's different from ourselves, whether it's youth, people of a different race, generation, people of a different ability level, people who are incarcerated, or any population which is different from our experience, we have to be doing a lot of work on ourselves and a lot of training to make sure we don't make things worse for them or make them feel like they don't belong, and to make sure we don't project our experiences onto them. So there are different methods for mindfulness. Here we practice Zazen, which is sitting quietly and stilling the mind. We also do other practices, like right now we're doing a Dharma talk where we share experience every week. We do Samu, which is work practice. So cleaning and garden work done mindfully are also very real ways to practice mindfulness. There are other traditions that do different kinds of breath work, body scans, guided meditation, compassion training, movement and walking meditation. These other traditions can include things like yoga and somatics, and they can incorporate movement and being present in the body in a different way. All of these different practices and traditions support different needs. And we should also be aware that practicing mindfulness in one aspect of life is not necessarily going to make mindfulness happen in all areas of our life. So, if I'm always practicing meditation on the cushion, I can get really good at focusing on my breath, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to be very good at focusing at work or focusing on something else. It might help, but it won't always translate. Similarly, if I'm practicing mindfulness in my body through movement and doing yoga poses, I might get better balance, better posture, better flexibility. But that's not necessarily going to make me a better cook. In order to be a better cook and not burn the food, I have to be practicing mindfulness in the kitchen while I'm cooking. So there's all these different applications, like mindfulness and relationships, family relationships, friendships, business relationships, relationships with children, relationships with significant others. And it takes effort on our part to make mindfulness a practice in all the areas of our life. One person might desperately need to apply mindfulness to their finances so that they can manage their money better. Someone else might really need to apply it to home care or to being a good steward of their body or to healing a relationship that's been difficult. So mindfulness can be adapted to fit personal life needs, but the person who's the expert on your personal life needs is you. So stand for doing what's right for you. Don't do things just because it's tradition, if it's causing harm to your body. And also respect others in doing what's right for them. Respect their choices. The next example I'm going to talk about is the findings of Dr. Helen Wang. She's a neuroscientist, clinical psychologist, and assistant professor at UCSF. What she found in her studies is that often when you hear news articles about meditation or mindfulness and how it affects the brain, what they do is they have a whole bunch of test subjects. Then they average the brain patterns. And then they'll say something like, well, when you meditate, this part of your brain is more active and this part is less active. And it's important to know that this is a vastly oversimplified view of things. Our brains are different. So when two different people are not meditating, they're going about their daily lives and they have very different brain activity depending on what's going on with them, their personality, what's happening in their life at the time. Then they sit down and meditate. Then they have different experiences during the meditation. And they will experience fluctuations throughout the meditation, right? So I might focus on my breath and calm my mind and be meditating. And then I'm like, oh, I forgot. I need to go to the grocery store. I have to get something later today because I need it for tomorrow. So then I make a mental note, okay, I'll go later this evening. Then I go back to meditating. And my mind is quiet and I'm breathing. And then I suddenly remember someone I haven't seen in 3 years. And I'm like, oh, I wonder how they're doing. I haven't heard from them in a really long time. I should check in with them. And then I come back to my breath and slow down again. So throughout a 40-minute meditation session, our brain is fluctuating all over the place. And there's all these different activity changes. And if you study an individual's brain waves, you might be able to see certain patterns, like, oh, when they're meditating, certain things slow down, or there's more activity here than there. But when you average these brain patterns across hundreds of different people, you completely lose all the useful information. It's going to be nonsense, right? Because when you take an average of like, okay, this person was distracted in this moment, but the other people were focused. And then in the next moment, someone was focused, but other people were distracted. It actually, like, you lose a lot of information that was relevant. So all of the data specific to people's actual experience gets lost, and you can't infer backwards once you've had all the data mixed together. However, when you deal with people's individual brains and individual experiences, then you can notice patterns and have more personalized, relevant information. You'll be able to see what things are helping different people. So it's important to call out that there's many articles based on the average brain. And the average brain is a myth. It doesn't actually exist. None of us match the average brain. Another important point that Dr. Helen Wang calls out is that researchers and control subjects for most of these studies on meditation and mindfulness are often Caucasian, healthy, and successful people. If anyone comes into the study and has a mental illness or neurological condition, they'll be instantly eliminated from the control group. If someone comes in with a physical condition, they'll be eliminated. So by the nature of things like systemic racism, we also have less test subjects and less people who are scientific researchers that are people of color. In neuroscience studies across the US that Dr. Wang researched, she found that 85% of the test subjects were Caucasian, 10% were Asian, less than 5% were Black or Latino, and less than 1% were Native American. So what that means is that when these news articles come out telling us about meditation and mindfulness, they won't be very accurate for neurodiverse people. They will be less relevant for people of color, less relevant for LGBTQ people, less relevant for people with medical health conditions, less relevant even for left-handed people, because the sample size of those people, those populations, is so small that it gets lost as noise in the group. So even the problems that a researcher is trying to solve and the way that they communicate their studies to the community will also be influenced by their own culture. So I could pick up some news articles about the average brain and the effects of meditation, and it could be completely wrong for me, not resonate at all with my experience, right? So a better way to approach neuroscience studies, and probably the way of the future, will be on a more individual basis, understanding a person's individual electromagnetic impulses, their individual brain activity and baseline, their own self-assessment reports on how things are affecting them. You know, understanding that people's brains are unique, just like a fingerprint. Our DNA carries the memories and traumas from our ancestors from many generations past. So we could experience fight or flight symptoms or responses, I should say, that has something to do with something that happened to one of our ancestors seven generations ago. And that memory is still alive in our blood and our DNA. There are also some videos on YouTube, such as Dr. Evan Thompson, titled Context Matters, Steps to an Embodied Cognitive Science of Mindfulness. He's from the Department of Philosophy, University of British Columbia, and the talk was recorded in 2015. And he shares that most articles on mindfulness and the brain are overgeneralized because it makes for clean, clear-cut news articles at the expense of accurately reflecting the complexity and diversity of the subject. So, about to wrap up, but the main thing I want to drive home is that science is now catching up with the reality that we're not all the same. You can't analyze a human or a brain in a box and assume that all humans or brains are going to respond the same way. We are very much shaped by the experiences of our youth and the environments we were brought up in. It actually changes the physiology of our brains. So the more we understand and respect our differences biologically and our uniqueness, the less likely we are to project our experiences on someone else in a harmful way. Some good examples of honoring differences are concepts like the five love languages that show that different people feel loved by different things. You know, some prefer quality time. Other people prefer words of affirmation. Other people love hugs. Other people hate hugs, right? And so things like that and the Myers-Briggs personality test show that, you know, some people are very analytical and they want you to respond with data and logic, and other people are more run by their feelings and they'll feel not listened to if you come up with just some solution and like they just want to be heard, right? So I used to work in fitness and taught dance fitness classes, and there were a lot of things that are consistent and repeatable in the human body. Like if you do a certain number of classes, you'll, you know, lose weight, you'll have better energy, cardiovascular health. You have to make exceptions for things like pregnancy and injuries. But in general, with physical exercise, things like muscle fatigue and physiological responses are pretty consistent across human beings. And sometimes there's this analogy of wanting to apply that fitness mentality to mindfulness, like meditation is a gym for the brain, but it's actually not. It doesn't translate. People have so many different factors. They have their family history, their mental patterns, their baseline neural activity and neural connections and different trauma levels. And they're also practicing in more or less supportive sanghas and environments. So with so many different variables, amounts of sleep, you know, how much stress they have, people's brain activity is so different that we cannot prescribe a certain mindfulness regime and get a specific enlightenment product, right? We have to listen to our bodies and walk our own path and understand what we need and how to take care of our own lives. So thank you. I'm now open for questions. And if you don't mind, I'm going to quickly turn on a light because it's dark here. So I'll be right back. All right. Now I'm back and we'll take any questions.
Thank you. I get coming from an interesting place, and it's things that you touched upon. I experienced severe neurological damage in my brain in the form, first it started out with the most extreme nausea I'd ever experienced in my life, which then led me to a session that I think was the closest I've ever come to the famous line of Shakespeare, "Who would endure this, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, when he might his quietus make with a bare bodkin?" Basically, I came as close as I've ever come to saying, you know what, I really want out of here. And if I had a knife, you know, I might actually use it. Well, unbeknownst to me, my brain was totally under the effect of a Gila, it's called a Gila stage 4 blastoma, which is a stage 4 cancerous tumor. Wow. that was fatal. And so I look at my community in Zen, and there is a Zen community, and it's the thing that's running it is that great teacher called life, you know, and it's the community of involuntary servitude to what? In my case, I identify with my being in the military, but it's also involuntary servitude, which I realize, to the functioning of my brain. Well, so what happened to me is I was lucky enough to be in a trauma unit over there at Kaiser, and a surgeon came in and realized that she was dealing, a very skilled German surgeon, realized that she was dealing with someone with a very advanced stage of cancer. And she got in there with a knife and drills and started opening my skull and digging out pieces of brain. And for me, that was just like, it's been an absolutely mind-boggling experience. And it's like, wow, I wonder what was in that piece that was dug out, you know, and how that, and all this started to unfold in a magical way. But let me just say that, and this is where I want to say, as far as being a privileged individual who was, in a way, yes, set up to deal with something like this. I had a advanced medical practitioner guiding me every step of the way. You know, do you go in for radiation treatment? Do you go in for whatever? And she had a very knowledgeable and experienced way, first of all, of getting me to realize I just wasn't ungodly nauseous and ready and suicidal based on anything. She realized I had something going on with my head. And immediately I was like, the doctor worked on me opened my skull and started scooping out all this stuff, you know. It's like, and as I realized, and people told me, you know, I must have had some karma with her, because her name was Cornelia, and my middle name is Cornelius. So Cornelia found Cornelius lying on the sink and started dealing with his brain stuff, you know, and it took her 50 minutes to get that nasty tumor to the point where it wasn't going to, you know, it had a chance of going into remission or ever, but some unknown future. But the point is, there was an immediate karmic thing, and that saved my life, you know, and it's the, and how many people are privileged enough to live that close to a unit that's specific at Kaiser Permanente that specifically deals with this type of tumor day in, day out. And these people are magnificent. That's all I can say. I tear up when I think of, it isn't just a surgeon, It's all the people that are getting you the right pills at the right time, that so you don't go into some kind of, and it really, really gives you a shift. Is that, and you're, my mindfulness was thinking about, gee, what is this mind? I mean, what was affected? What was my mind before? What is it now? Am I trying to get something back? Or I don't know what I'm doing. Really, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what, but I've really thought about, one of the biggest things I thought about was, there's so many things that have come out in my recovery. It's like they had me starting out, they had me doing intellectual exercises because that part of my brain wasn't getting exercise. So I started playing these crazy mind games, which were turned out to be quite helpful. But the thing that gripped me the most was this idea that some of this stuff that was the stuff subject to glioblastoma stage 4 cancer was the way I related to people. The way I, I showed up at meditation. I took a little break, but I showed up at meditation and I started thinking about this. And I had some very, very, very unusual experiences of suddenly, meditating. And then all of a sudden thinking of my brain kind of flipped into this modality where suddenly it was at peace and I was sleeping. Or I wasn't able to sleep, or I was having trouble with thing, you know, getting stuck. And that could be, when it comes to, I'm a very big believer in go with the flow. And that includes all your processes. Number one and number two in the commode, all these things will affect you and affect your brain. And how do you navigate through this? And at the same time, I had who I think in this whole process, I encountered in my community. To me, what he went through with involuntary servitude. He was from a Marine Corps family. Generations of his families had gone in and risked their lives, including an uncle who was one of the very first people to go to Germany, to go to Auschwitz and deal with it. Wow. And I got goosebumps. Because this very same individual was riding along in a vehicle in Iraq when he was driving. He was in the driver's seat and he was on the left-hand side and he chose to be on the left-hand side and he chose to drive. And guess what? Karma spoke. You, Jacob Schick, are going to be driving over a improvised explosive device that's going to drive your entire body right through the top of your vehicle. And that's what happened to him. And somehow he remained conscious and he survived this. And the pain and the number of operations that he went through. The point is, to me, when I look at Jacob Schick and how he went through this process, first of all, I'm staggered at his courage to even go through it. And one of the biggest issues, you know, in the process of going through this, he's worked with fellow veterans and he realized this is big stuff that's affecting my community. And he identified some of those processes that we work with in our retreats and in our process. He identified them into four categories that were really causing an inordinate level of suicide. And those four processes were relationships, all the stuff that we deal with every day, relationship, finances, self-medication. Where do, how do I do this?
Yeah.
And, it's just been an absolute stunning journey for me because it made me realize that this kind of this karmic DNA that I think we all are dealing with is deeply, deeply embedded right there. And it's so complex and it's so subtle. And there's so many factors. How do you parse this?
Thanks.
And the way you parse it, I think meditation does. The biggest thing is like be in the present and say, look, okay, you got this condition. Your sister who's a practitioner says, don't do this because I've seen people try and it doesn't work. Do I trust her? Do I not trust her? Well, I've come to is trust in life, in your community, as the world has presented it to you. And I cannot tell you how supported I felt from, I can think of 10 or 15, mostly from practitioners at Kaiser who would bring me food, who would help me with physical therapy, with occupational therapy. You know, like it's, you've got to maintain your high hand-eye coordination. They help me every day with such an open, generous, and skillful means. And then my family and the Zen community, all the outpouring of support. And yes, dare I say, love from these people who I just feel this connection with because, yeah, we've sat together. And that means a lot. That means a lot. Mm-hmm. And when there, and it's also reunited me with my family. I've had, I've had some issues with my family. And, you know, at the end of the day, life is way too short, especially if you see the end game, right? It's way too short to drag your personal stuff. Oh, you know, me and my ex-wife really didn't get along very well. And I think there was some blah, 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 whatever your mind goes. All that stuff, I think of those as chunks of brain matter on the table. I wonder if she got dug some of that stuff. I wonder if it's going to come back, you know? It's like, it leaves you with the absolute myriad of mysteries that is life and the myriad of mysteries that is in our brain because our brain is command central. But who's running command central? You know, and I say in this Jacob Schick, this fellow who was blasted through this, you know, to me, unspeakable courage of his life to be willing to go through. He went through months of operations to have his body put back together. And that wasn't the worst of it. The worst of it was the addiction that he was left with. You fixed me, but now I'm an addict. I'm useless because I am so addicted, you know, that I no longer, you know, and it's such a moving story. I really, to me, to see his path of courage. And you know what the big payoff is? He has been of genuine service to his community. Of involuntary servitude and integrity based on these kind of karmic relationships. Who knows? All I know is that when Jacob Schick went into that camp, he could have saved the life of one of my ancestors, mm-hmm. who were all, many of them were interred in various camps in Eastern Europe. So I'm staggered, frankly. I'm staggered by the experience. And was it Zen? I think it was Zen because, you know what? It takes you and takes you by your lapels, and it makes you look at everything. How could all this stuff be embodied in these bits of gray matter material that we call the brain? Mm-hmm. How does this stuff all work together? That's, you know, and how do these people figure out how to treat these things? You know, it's just, I've got to stop because I'll keep rambling on forever. But I'd be, you know, open to maybe answering a question or asking a question. Bonnie, imagine your brain is all in these bits and pieces and it's there in these little parts. But does it make sense to say, well, I wonder the part that works on me when I'm trying to go to sleep, and I can't go to sleep, or I'm so irritated about something, you know? And how do I, in the context of the absolute reality of this thing is going to kill me, it's not if it's going to kill me, it's just a question of when, of time, you know? So how do you readjust to that? And I think there's a lot of answers that you've already given. And that mindfulness contains an infinitude of relationships. And each one of those ones, just like you talking tonight, I would just like you to contemplate. Maybe you've had some experience with people who have had real physical neurological conditions and how that works. I believe meditation is a very valid approach. And do you suffer? Yes. And it's that suffering is in the more intense it is, in a way, the better. You know? Anyway, I need to my partner say, give it a rest. He's heard this story too many times. It's like, let other people talk.
Thanks, Einari. I'm gonna tell you what I can hear in your speaking, okay?
Okay.
So you actually had a lot in there. So the first thing that came up is interdependence, because you're like, people saved my life and they knew how to fix it. I mean, if that's not a wake-up call that we actually depend on other people for our very life, that was a clear example. But sometimes it happens more subtly. The, you know, food doesn't grow in grocery store aisles. So one of the foundational things we can understand is we are dependent, interdependent on other people for our mutual survival. And that's a very precious relationship that we shouldn't take for granted, right? And like, so I think you realize that. The other thing that you brought up is a big shift in your consciousness because of something happening to you physiologically. So your life was one way, and then something physical happens and it changes your whole experience of life. And then something else happens and it's back almost to normal again. And so understanding that at different moments in our life, we're in very different mental states and our capacity for different things, it fluctuates, right? And then you brought up ancestral trauma, right? And that's a very heavy and deep topic, but it's also a very important one because you have ancestors that went to Auschwitz. I mean, that is really intense trauma and at the same time, really intense wisdom that they survived something so terrible and passed it on, that knowledge on to you in some way. And that's the continuity of life, that, you know, when you, like we all, none of us are going to get out of life alive, right? Eventually we're going to go, but, you know, it's just our physical individual existence that is going to go. But just like your ancestors are still with you and speaking to you and inspiring you generations after they passed, you will still be connected to and speaking to all the people you were close with, all the people that loved you, all the people that you loved.
Feel them. I feel them. I feel them with it as a tangible presence. And I think a key point you made is interdependence. The other one is impermanence. You know, you wake up, you're not going to be like this. You're not going to be dealing with your, you know, whatever it is. I've had a little thing going with a certain, and a lot of it is frankly my ship, you know, it's my ship. And I started to realize, you know, in those cells, there was a lot of stuff that I had, you know, repentances, all my ancient twisted karma. There's some ancient twisted karma that got just literally cycled right in there by, guess what? Me, myself, and I. Who else got it in there, you know? The way I reacted to certain situations, including family situation. You know, I had some issues with whatever. But the point is, it's like we are being guided, instructed, and enlightened by a myriad of things, including all the fundamentals that you brought up, including the fact that we're right here, right now, talking about this, and you're listening to me. And one of my responsibilities is to listen to you and not talk too much, not to say, you know what, I had this experience, and boy, it was really tough, and now I figured a whole bunch of stuff out. Well, that's really not true. If anything, I got more questions. And if anything, but in some ways, I have less questions, because I believe in this process of meditation, and that can bring up it. What it all brings up is various forms of suffering, and we learn when we suffer. And yeah. I don't want it to sound. It's a joyful thing, you know, and if I look at Jacob Schick and what he experienced and how he came through it, he is a bodhisattva. I mean, so he's a Marine veteran, and he has a son, and he says he taped on the wall of his son's bathroom, it says something like, I wish I remember exactly what it was, but it was, be humble, work hard, and give back. Those are the things he said. I want you to read that, repeat it 3 times before you go in. And when you go out, I want you to read it and repeat it again 3 times. You know, this is a disciplinarian. And this discipline, which allowed him to go through this, is also part of something that he's been able to pass on. It's enlightenment. You know, in the way I see it is, you know, from my perception, I didn't have those kind of insights necessarily to instruct my kids. Maybe there were other ones, but this is phenomenal in my view of, and it's all based on suffering, dukkha, impermanence, and realizing what is the nature of this brain that we all. What is the nature? Where is the good karma? Where is the bad karma? Where does all this stuff actually reside? And it resides right up here in this stuff. And so now I've had big trauma to it. Well, how the heck is this going to put itself back together? And I'll tell you one answer, and that stuns me and brings me to my knees and to tears, is the dedication of these workers. I know there's the Virgin of Guadalupe is very strong practice here in this community. And the Virgin of Guadalupe was the Virgin Saint for all these people who are considered, you know, of a less of a lower, you know, lower, whatever you want to call it, status, and they have very hard lives, and their lives are filled with injustice, and the Virgin provides them solace. And this is documented in real, where people actually have visions of this. And my gosh, I got to say thank you to the Virgin, because she, and of course the other big, the female kind of pantheon on my altar, I think would be the Virgin and of course Kuan Yin Avalokiteshvara, who cries tears for me and for all those who are suffering from the effects of involuntary servitude. Things happen to them that they had no real control of. So and Avalokiteshvara has, of course, that infinite compassion. So these are the things that I look to the divine feminine. I feel a connection to the divine feminine when I meditate with my Kuan Yin, when I meditate with a picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe, when I meditate with an image of my mother, who was not only someone who had suffered greatly in her life, and who was also a victim of involuntary servitude. She was a veteran, and she was summarily dismissed from her own country because of some very reactionary things. You're a woman. You're less. Mm-hmm. You're a second-class citizen. You know, wow, what's that all about? Come on. Wait a minute. I served in your military, and now you're kicking me out of your country because due to my gender, mm-hmm. in a total patriarchal society, I'm not worthy of being your country anymore, even though I was, mm-hmm. you know, it's all very convoluted and mixed up. And somehow it all gets parsed. I don't know.
Thank you, Dainary. I will stay on after this, after the Q&A, if you want to talk more.
Okay. The one big thing is I'm looking for feedback. Talk less. That's what I'm getting from people.
Well, you're processing a lot. So just, you know, giving you some credit, you are processing a lot of stuff from many generations. I can hear the generations that are speaking out of your DNA. So, you know, your mother's oppression, the oppression of the divine feminine, which has been going on for thousands of years. It's not going to be solved overnight, but, you know, you're processing a lot of stuff and keep doing your best and focus on what inspires you, suffering can be a teacher, but there are other teachers too. Joy can be a teacher as well. So I'll stay on afterwards if you want to talk more about it, okay? And I hope you have the resources and support you need.
Oh, Bonnie, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much for, you know, and this is a kind of a universal level of concern and empathy and willingness to take on my ship. Because a lot of it is just my ship, you know. I generated a lot of the sacred twisted karma for me. And one of the really interesting questions is that comes up in these repentances. There's two versions. One is, I want to avow it. And the other one is atone. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a bind. Do I avow this? It's pretty easy to avow it. Oh, yeah, it all happened to me. Can I atone it? Can I actually do something to make amends? Because when I looked at, you know, when I think about that stuff on that table, a lot of that came from my process. And I can't say, no, you know, so-and-so, such-and-such made me do it. My nasty patriarchal grandfather was behind all this thing. Anyway, I need a timeout.
Thanks, Denary. I'll stay on after. Yeah, we can take other questions first, but I don't know. I think this belief that we deserve to suffer is what perpetuates our suffering. You know, that in some way we need to suffer is, it's not the only way of looking at things. Les?
Denary, you're not alone. Okay. Yeah, we're kind of running out of time, Bonnie.
Yeah, so it's 9 o'clock, but I do want to give a few minutes for anyone else if they have any questions. And if you need to drop off, it's 9 o'clock, you can feel free to drop off, but I do want to give a little bit of time in case anyone else had questions. And thank you, Les. I know, you know, you understand. Are there any other questions or should we call it a night? I am available if there are other questions. Brenda?
I don't have a question particularly. I just want to say it was a wonderful presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brenda. Right. Anything else?
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.